Welcome to the Lizzie Borden Podcast, Episode 28. I am your host, Stephanie Corey, filling in for the late Richard Behrens, author of the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective series of mysteries. The Lizzie Borden Podcast is the only podcast entirely devoted to the study of the Borden murders of 1892, Lizzie Borden, and sometimes the history of her hometown, Fall River, Massachusetts. Produced by Nine Muses Books and Anna Behrens. Each episode explores some aspect of the mystery that is Lizzie Borden, from the origins of the doggerel Lizzie Borden took an axe, to a primer on the case by noted authors and experts, including dramatic readings of Richard Behrens' Lizzie Borden Girl Detective mystery series. In this episode, we interview Dennis Bennett, co-author of many books published by the Fall River Historical Society, including The Knowlton Papers, Women at Work, The Fall River Discourse Series, The Knowlton Pearson Correspondence, The Jennings Journals, and Parallel Lives, A Social History of Lizzie A. Borden and Her Fall River. From his many years as assistant curator at the Fall River Historical Society, Dennis is an acclaimed expert at research and sourcing information relating to Fall River history and the life of Lizzie Borden and the Borden murders. Dennis shares his tips, techniques, stories of working on the books, and research tools with us today. And now, the Lizzie Borden Podcast presents part one of an interview with Dennis Bennett. Dennis Bennett is a native of Fall River. Many of his earliest memories involve the enjoyment of or acquiring books. Very fortunate to have grown up with parents who encouraged his intellectual pursuits, he eventually discovered the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature, which became one of his first favorite research tools. With a background in English literature, along with photography, film studies, and filmmaking, Dennis's early career experience was not in any of these fields, rather dealing with banking, database management, and financial analysis. Oddly enough, these areas often required fine problem-solving techniques, which, in a sense, is the heart of intense research. Over 30 years ago, Dennis first made a connection with the Fall River Historical Society, where he joined the staff and was appointed assistant to the curator, Michael Martins. Together, the two would research, edit, write several publications, the first of which was The Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus Lizzie A. Borden, The Knowlton Papers, 1892 to 1893, the first collection of primary source material on the case, appearing 101 years after the trial. Most notable of their collaborations was the monument to their research skills, Parallel Lives, A Social History of Lizzie A. Borden and Her Fall River. Currently retired, Dennis works with the Fall River Historical Society as a consultant on various research projects and is also involved with various projects in the publishing world. He resides in Massachusetts. Welcome, Dennis.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to know who this guy is. Jeez.
It's you. You are the man of many talents.
Wow. Oh.
We have a lot in common, though, because I wanted to always be in theater, and I ended up being in the business side of theater, which was not my intention, but I loved it.
Sometimes you just get led in one direction, and oddly enough, a lot of mine had to do with financial fields, and that was my worst subject in school. So it's go figure. You never quite know where it's going to lead you, but eventually you come around sooner or later to what you were meant to do.
And it uses all of you, so you put your all into something and it uses all of you, so you feel satisfied by that.
Right.
Which is the topic of today, which is something completely satisfying for me, something very excited about, which is research tools, and researching Fall River and Lizzie Borden, which is something I would consider an ultimate expert at during your years of doing the work you've had with the Historical Society, plus your education, which is in English, I think you said.
English lit, yes.
Yeah, so.
That and a dime will get you a cup of coffee.
Maybe so, but I think you have a lot to offer our listeners so that they can understand maybe how they can better track down what they're looking for or know where to go to find it or that certain things just don't exist anymore, maybe even.
Sure. There are some things that, and as we go through this, you're going to find, or listeners will find, that there are essential things that we have now as research tools when research in the past that we have to be very careful about preserving going forward. And I'll come to that at some point when we're talking about the research that we're doing.
And today we have research tools that were never around when you were doing Knowlton papers that makes it so much easier as records keep getting added to certain databases and further genealogical information becomes available, as well as searchable databases with newspaper archives. It didn't exist before.
No, the tools are amazing. And it's interesting because what we have here to deal with today, and my experience in all of this, is the difference between doing research on a project like the Knowlton Papers, which was published in 1994, and doing research for Parallel Lives, which was 20 years later,
right,
with a whole different method of approaching research. And in a lot of ways, I prefer the old method.
Really?
It you get that eureka moment, you know? That you've dug.
Oh, I've done that. I've actually been told to be quiet in the Historical Society library. Yeah. Shh, shh, you're yelling too much. I go, but I found her.
Yeah. Yep. You get that online too, but I guess the blood, sweat, and tears going into it is different. It's, you can get carpal tunnel maybe, but it's not the same.
But the fun is in the pursuit.
In the hunt.
In the hunt, yes. Exactly. It's like a detective. Uh-huh. It's a history detective.
Well, my big joke when Michael and I were working on the Knowlton Papers, that would be Michael Martin's, is that we had, at some points, we should have put our detective hats on. And I fully expected to go to work someday, and we would automatically have Venetian blinds with a little bit of sunlight coming through. There'd be cigar smoke in the office. Michael would be sitting there with his feet on the desk with a fedora on, and, you know, It was that kind of feeling, and it's a good feeling. It's a very good feeling. I think that people underestimate the amount of satisfaction and joy, honestly, that comes from successful researching and actually winning in the end and getting what you're looking for, or getting something that you didn't even know you were looking for, which is the best part.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Those unexpected surprises, including your years as assistant curator at the Society. How long do you think you've been working and associated with that organization?
Over 30 years now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Has it been that long?
Yeah. It's funny, but when I was growing up, I always wanted to be one of those people, you know, that they had a career and a job that they loved and whatever. And I was working in jobs and the company got acquired. The company downsized. The defense budget was cut. So my contract was done away with on the Navy base. You know, it was all, and I would say to myself, you know, where are these people? Where did these people work that got these long-term jobs? And then I ended up at the Historical Society, and lo and behold, you know, 30 years later, I said, oh, well, that was what it was all about.
Were you trained within the Society from Michael or Mrs. Brigham, or, I mean, how did that work out with your beginning skills of being an assistant curator?
Michael.
Yeah.
I would say Michael. I worked with Mrs. Brigham at the very beginning. She was one of the cheerleaders to get me hired, and she was a wonderful, wonderful woman.
I never met her.
It was a privilege to meet Mrs. Brigham. It really was. And so we worked hand in hand. She was doing directory work. I would be the gopher and get her directories for her. Then she'd open the desk drawer and pull out some chocolates and tell you, take two. You know, two's better than one. You know. So that was my introduction to Historical Society. But Michael was excellent in pointing me in the right direction as far as research tools concerned. He just, the rest of it was baptism by fire.
Right. Self-learning.
Yeah.
Because you have to, you look, now where can I look now? I don't know. Let's just look at everything.
Yeah.
And then you stumble upon a research tool that you can massage and use and know what it's about and know what's in it and know how to find things in it.
So. And the more you do delve into different avenues, the more you realize what corners you can cut to get to a certain point, which is good. Mm. You know, it's, you know, like looking someone up in the directories before 1921, you're guaranteed that if it's a man, if he's married, his wife's not going to be there.
Right.
But then you, where do you go? You go to the official census, you know, your United States census, and that tells you who lives in the household, what the relationships were, and everything else. So you can use that, and that's your foot in the door, and then you know, oh, that's what the wife's name is. So now right. I know that the Joshua that I'm looking for is married to a Hannah. So anytime you see a Joshua, it's married to a Maria. Wrong Joshua. So you use things like that to get to the, as I said, the Eureka moment and say, aha.
Unless the enumerator in the census got the name wrong, which has happened.
Which happens big time.
The Fall River Historical Society produces such top-notch research. They do books and papers on various subjects relating to the history of Fall River and Lizzie Borden. Can you list for us some of the works you've edited, written, and researched over the years with them?
Sure. The first being the Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus Lizzie A. Borden, the Knowlton Papers, 1892 to 1893. And that's a very good story in itself right there, that book. Other collections, Women at Work, which you were also a party to, edited that with Michael and you.
And Joyce Rodericks.
And then there was the history.
The Discourses
series. And that's a great series. And Michael came up with the idea of finally making available these papers that we had. If you were a member of the Historical Society, and granted, at the very beginning, there were some people that were descendants of the founders of the city, and many had free time on their hands to be doing this research in a city that they loved, and they produced these papers. So when you had a members meeting of the Historical Society, you had a member that did a presentation.
Why don't we do that again?
It was wonderful. Bob Kitchen is one of our members who has done those in the past. Bill Gonzalo also has done Phil Sylvia. I'm probably going to miss somebody, and I didn't want to, but but anyway, they would present these papers, and so we had this file of them. We have all the originals. So Michael decided that it was time to make them public. So we did, edited them, supplemented their text with some historical data.
And images.
Fleshed it out. Yeah. And images, there are thousands, tens of thousands of images in the Historical Society's collection. It's a fantastic resource for photo images. And came up with some really handsome books. The one written by Edward S. Adams is The Underground Railroad and Anti-Slavery in Fall River. Just great history about the Underground Railroad and things that you don't really associate with Fall River. One of my favorite stories there is that of a woman who was a teacher out at Steep Brook, the north end of Fall River, up North Main Street. And in the summers, she would go down and she would teach black children how to read in Virginia. And this is in the years of the Civil War. Well, that alone, for a woman on her own to be doing that, was a courageous feat. But she also became very, very attached to some of the children. And there was one boy who had been repeatedly beaten by his master because he had tried to escape, and he went to her for help, and she helped him when she was returning at the end of the summer to Massachusetts. She hid him under her hoop skirt on the train and put her bags in front of her, and when the boy's master was storming through the train to reclaim his quote-unquote personal property, she stood up to it and refused to break down and admit that she was hiding the child. And she brought the child to freedom. And Robert Adams, who was very active in Fall River in the Underground Railroad, took the boy under his wing, educated him, and he was forever a paid staff member of the Adams household.
Wow.
Which I think is a great story. I mean, from being hung by your thumbs in a barn and whipped until you bled, to working for a nice man like Robert Adams.
An abolitionist
in Fall River.
Yep. That's great. That's in and of itself.
But there are little stories like this in these papers. Another one was about the North Main Street or South Main Street in the 1870s and 1880s. And that's a charmer. There are so many little stories in that piece. And again, supplemented with some fantastic photographs and whatever.
Yeah, so. I've been posting some of those on the Historical Society site Facebook page and get a lot of responses from that.
Well, they're great. The books are great because they're in little vignettes that you get about this or about that. And I mean, you can sit down and read the whole thing, but you can pick it up and just read a little bit and then say, oh, tomorrow I want to read something else.
Well, he goes walking through Fall River and he talks about what's on the left-hand side of the road and the right-hand side of the road and who's in which business. And oh, yeah, that reminds me of King, somebody who used to ride his horse and come to work and then leave the horse but not tie the horse up, and the horse would wander away during the day, but people would find it and bring it back.
The thing that I love about his paper is this is Thomas Borrell. He was young when he was experiencing all of this. He presented the paper in the 1930s, and his my favorite story of his is that of Mr. Boomer in City Hall, in the basement of City Hall. It was a market, and there was a man there who was a fish dealer. Now, the Quickwashan River ran through Fall River and actually ran under or nearby City Hall. It was sort of a waste dump for the factories and whatever. But also, as it turns out, we know from Burrell, he bought some fish. And he brought it home to his mother from Mr. Boomer in the basement of, or the cellar of, the City Hall. And the thing about Mr. Boomer's fish is that he would rinse it off in the running water of the Quickwashan River before he gave it to the person that was purchasing it. And when his mother found out that Thomas had purchased it from Mr. Boomer, she said, "We will have no more fish from Mr. Boomer anymore in this household."
Oh,
it's little
God.
Things like that they're just special.
Who knew that?
Really?
Yeah. Who knew? And you can just picture these stories, the way he tells them, the various characters of the city. The guy with one leg, was it? Or one arm?
There's a man with a club foot.
Right.
And there was Pinky, the man with six fingers that worked in the telegraph office.
Right, because he could. He could go fast.
Yeah, he had an extra pinky.
An extra finger.
Yeah. But the sweet moment is there were four men, I guess, that were walking down the city streets when it was quiet after dusk, singing. And they're just the mellow tones of their voices were kind of weaving through the empty streets, and you just picture that. You can hear it. You can hear it. Yeah. It's, and all of these things are going to be captured in these volumes. So it's really exciting.
Yeah, I loved it. I love working on those projects too. Then you said Parallel Lives. Oh wait, we missed what? We missed Parallel Lives. We missed the other books that you worked on there. There's more books than that. We missed the Jennings Journals and Parallel Lives.
Oh, and the Knowlton Pearson Correspondence.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. The thing, why don't we start with the Knowlton Papers?
Okay.
And we'll work our way up.
Can you tell us a bit about the process of turning a document or a collection of documents into a book?
Yes. The collection came into the Historical Society through Hosea Morrill Knowlton, who was the prosecuting attorney, through his grandson. It was a collection of over 300 documents that really had never seen the light of day except for once, which we found out later on, which we'll talk about later. But here we had this collection that had not been gone through in any way whatsoever. And
it hadn't been organized?
Had not been organized. Okay. And the question is, okay, what are we going to do with it? I was just coming on board at this time. I was the new kid on the block. I was asked by the president that was president at that time of the organization if I would work with Michael on this book. I don't know why. I have no idea why. But we did. It was a very grueling experience. One, making sense of the collection. The most sensible way to do it was just to, regardless of what type of manuscript it was, to put them in chronological order as best you could. Or if they were undated, to try to guesstimate what the date is and gather those together as undated documents pertinent to this period. So that was the first step. And getting them transcribed, understanding what they said.
What kind of things were in the collection?
Everything. Everything from official documents, indictments, summonses, and things along that line, the jurors' lists. Mm-hmm. That were reviewed by the attorneys, and correspondence between attorneys and the Attorney General of the state, Pillsbury, at the time, and letters from people of unknown origins, shall we say, a variety of people that sort of came out of the woodwork and in some cases probably crawled out from under rocks to send crank letters and not so crank letters, offering criticism of the investigation, offering ideas as to who the perpetrator might have been. In support of Lizzie Borden, against Lizzie Borden, all kinds of.
Were there any legal transcriptions or the secret first volume of the inquest? Was that ever?
No.
No.
We did have Knowlton's notebooks, which were very interesting. They were kept as he was questioning various people that were eligible for jurors duty.
Yes.
At that point, and his notes on them.
Ooh.
Like, he is with us, you know, things like that, and interesting. And looking back on it, there's so much, and we address this in Parallel Lives. There is so much misinformation and downright lies and exaggerations and gossipy kinds of remarks made about Lizzie Borden, and oddly enough, the source of many of those turned out to be in the Knowlton papers, because there are things like one letter written by a minister from, I believe, Rehoboth, Massachusetts, who said that he had heard that Lizzie Borden had wanted to have a funeral, so she found a nest full of baby robins and she strangled them all so that she could play funeral. Of course, there's not any sort of place you can go to verify this is actual fact. So here we go. The first of many sensational stories that found their roots right there. Lizzie chopped off the head of Abby Borden's cat, you know.
Right.
That was Tisha Thomas, I believe her name was. She was a manicurist in Boston on Tremont Street, and this woman went to the manicurist, and she heard this story from her manicurist that Lizzie had chopped off the head of her stepmother's cat. I mean, what do you talk about when you're getting your nails done, right?
Right. Well, I don't know.
Well, yeah, neither do I, but apparently was the topic of conversation after the Borden murders.
Well, I think we found out by Parallel Lives 20 years later that those who knew Lizzie Borden loved her and had nothing bad to say about her.
Right.
And then
right.
Everybody else who didn't know her, they made up things about her to fit their own narrative of whether she was guilty or not.
Oh, that's true. And we'll definitely address that when we talk about Parallel Lives. But that's sort of been the issue with books that have been written over the years. It's not to mention any names. But
oh, mention names. It's all right.
But there are certain authors that would take something twist it to fit their mold.
Of course.
Frank Spearing.
Yes.
Okay.
It's the
Lizzie.
Worst one.
Quoted a letter that Lizzie had written to her dressmaker. It's in the collection of the Historical Society. And roughly to quote it, I had a dream about you last night and I dare not put it into words. Well, it was an elderly woman that was her dressmaker. And Spearing turned it around and said that it was a love letter and to another woman, and that Lizzie was a lesbian. And that was the anchor that he built his whole theory on. And it wasn't a love letter. If you read the rest of the letter and take it in context, it was written to an elderly dressmaker, my guess. And if I was writing that to an elderly woman, I would guess that I had had a dream about the woman dying. And I would not even want to speak it or write it down because it would be a horrible thing. And that's the type of thing that you see all along the way, is twisting fact to support your quote-unquote nonfiction.
And the Historical Society takes no position on the guilt or innocence of Lizzie Borden.
No, as they shouldn't and as they wouldn't. If you weren't there in the room, how would you know?
No kidding.
You're working on parallel lives again. What we uncovered about Lizzie was so different than the Lizzie Borden that had been painted by history and rumor, that it became increasingly more and more difficult to put her into that mold. Not saying that it was not possible to, but her whole person, her whole character was fleshed out, and she became a human being instead of a caricature. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the most important thing about parallel lives as far as Lizzie's concerned. There are other extremely important things about that book that have nothing to do with Lizzie. But we're going to talk about that later, aren't we?
You're going to tell me about transcribing things. How do you read someone else's handwriting and know for certain you've got it right?
You expose yourself to the handwriting so much, whether it be one letter or a series of letters, a diary, and you start to try to think in the way they are writing. You look at how did they write an A, or how did they cross their T's? You know, in this word. So is that little mark there over the word, is that a T crossed? Is that little spike a T?
Or is that an L?
An L? Yeah. Sometimes it's right down to that.
Letter by letter by letter.
Now, here's a great time for me to get on my soapbox, because in working in research like this, I think I get too emphatic about things sometimes. I think it's blasphemous to assume that we can go forward in time and not learn to read and write cursively. I think that it's insane, mainly knowing that in working on the Knowlton papers, if I couldn't read handwriting, I would be up a creek trying to transcribe those letters. And handwriting, cursive handwriting, should not be something that you have to get a degree in. It should be something that you learn that just comes along the way. I mean, what happens if you're reading an old book and there's something in italics? All of a sudden, you can't read italics? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a question that really needs to be addressed, because between our disposable nature and the willingness to surrender the knowledge of cursive writing, I think we're endangering ourselves going forward for historical research.
Census records are all cursive.
Right. Census records are all cursive. Emails. We could not have written parallel lives in 100 years, because the bulk of our paper research were diaries that were kept on paper and correspondence through the mails. Paper correspondence.
Yep.
Not sending an email and putting it in trash because you read it. Where's the history there in the correspondence? You can write to somebody for years through emails and nobody would even know.
That's true.
And so I think that in the increase in wonderful technology that we've gone through in the past decades, we really need to look at retaining some of the old school methods, because...
How about a typewriter? My mom had a typewriter that typed in cursive.
Yeah.
That's all it typed in.
Well, they had the typewriters where you could change the little ball.
The ball, yeah. It's electric, and you do a cursive ball. Yeah. Yeah. So maybe we have to think of telling the computer to type it in cursive so we could learn it that way, even.
Yeah.
So that people can get a handle on it. I never thought about people. I hear people talking about cursive and they're not teaching it and it's a shame. And I don't understand why that's a shame. I don't understand what is important about cursive. But then when you talk, it is another language in a sense. It's another formation of letter pattern that unless you know how to do it yourself, you can't pick it out in other people. So they might not know, if they've never learned cursive, what an S looks like in cursive, what a G looks like in cursive, or whatever. Mm. And I never thought about it.
Well, a good example is two S's. If you look at a document that's old enough, in Massachusetts, abbreviated, would look like M-A-F-F.
Yeah.
And knowing that.
Right.
Then you know that that's M-A-S-S. But it's things like that, that if you're not exposed to it, you'll never comprehend it. It'll be like trying to read a foreign language.
It's like kids who can't tell the time with a...
Oh.
They need a digital clock.
I actually was in the presence of an adult that thought that quarter past 11 was 25 after. Because a quarter was 25 cents.
Oh. Well, they were using logic.
Well, yeah. Yes, but they're going to be late.
Good point. Logically, you're late.
Right. Anyway, back to Nolden Papers.
Back to Nolden Papers. And then those stunning glossaries. Don't forget your stunning glossaries.
Oh. Okay, put yourself back into 1994. And we have to do research on this book. We have a bunch of letters written by people, many of whom we don't know the identity of, outside of a name, if you're lucky enough to get a name. There were some that were sent anonymously by someone who signed their letter Justice. But
maybe then, that's their last name.
Then you have, could be. Then you have Octavia Althorpe, a typewritten letter, which in 1892, a typewritten letter was something. Mm. So you know that she had to have been...
She had a secretary.
A secretary, yeah. Or that she was wealthy enough to afford a home typewriter. Turns out she was married to a man who was very involved in the arts in Boston. And so we found out all about her. But then there were other people that oddly, I can't remember his first name. His last name was Osbaldston. And we found his obituary. This man had written a letter on yellow lined paper. I don't know if anybody remembers from elementary school the yellow lined paper. And that's what his letter was written on. He was a odd duck. He was buried in silk pajamas, according to his instructions. And he was known to be seen doing calisthenic exercises by the railroad tracks in New Jersey where he lived. Seems that he lived an outdoor life. He was homeless, but he was a character.
Wow.
A character enough to have been known and had an obituary written about him.
And he happened to write a letter to
Nolden.
And
he wrote a letter to Nolden.
And now we know about him. Otherwise, no one would know about him.
So in doing the research for the glossaries, we were just diving in. Okay, some people were attorneys, and that was the easy part. And,
right.
You know, you'd get biographical information there. But trying to find information on these out of the way people that really.
How'd you find his obituary? Well, Oswald.
Well, it's an odd name.
Okay. No, but how did you find it? Because this was before the newspapers were searchable.
Oh, thank you. Well, it was just a matter of making phone calls and finding the right place.
Oh, really? So this is before you look things up. This was actually making phone calls to find somebody. Because you knew maybe this guy was from New Jersey.
Oh,
somewhere.
You never quite knew what you were going to have to do as far as research was concerned.
Everybody was different, right?
Yes. Yeah. And sometimes you had to pretend to be a relative. And it's amazing. You can be just about anything at the other end of a phone line that you want to be.
But sometimes you'd use like representative men of Massachusetts.
Oh, for God, people, yes. Who were representative men and
Southeastern.
The history of Bristol County,
right.
The 3-volume.
Right.
That was, and then there was another book. It was very useful in finding photographs of some of the attorneys that were mentioned.
It's almost like a who's who, but it's not.
Yes,
a who's who,
yeah,
right.
It's interesting that Knowlton lost the case, but the volume of correspondence that he received that congratulated him on his excellent preparation and delivery.
Don't you think
astounding.
A lot of people felt sorry for him because he got thrust this case where he knew he was going to lose?
So they had to
like pat him on the back somehow, right?
Well, and really, when you read the Knowlton papers,
it's the only place you can find this information, by the way.
Right. The Knowlton papers was published in 1994. The trial was in 93. So 101 years after the trial, the first volume of primary source material surfaced, and it was published by the Fall River Historical Society.
So this is the first time that we're looking at the back side of the case, the inner workings between Pillsbury and Knowlton, and the conversations that they had through correspondence about the case, the guidance he got, or lack thereof. Right. And his correspondence with the other attorneys that he was working with.
Right.
On the prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
And you said even the jury information and who he liked and who he thought was on their side. And so you've got this story that is kind of fleshed out by these disparate things that get pulled together into a book.
Exactly.
And so you have to read it from the beginning to the end to go, oh, that's why that happened.
The collection reads with a narrative thread, which we were hoping it would. And people that were among the first readers did say that there was a thread that followed through.
Right.
You can see how Knowlton ended up with the case. You can see how he dealt with building the case, and you can see what the correspondence was like between legal offices while all of this thing was coming to a boil.
And even him going back home on the weekends and coming back and doing his research and coming into the city, and then both Fall River and New Bedford. Mm-hmm. And then going back to his home and just this idea of he's fleshed out as well, just as a man with a life.
Right.
You
know? It's interesting. After the book came out, I had the pleasure of conducting a tour with Knowlton descendants. And when we got to the Lizzie Borden collection, part of the tour. they were like mercury spilling. They just went blah all over the place, and they were looking in the cabinets. And then one of the women was pointing at Knowlton's photograph, and she said, "Oh, there he is, old Hosey." And that was the first exposure I ever had to his family nickname.
Hosey.
Hosey, which is okay. That's fine. But it was funny. It's moments like that that you really enjoy. The book itself does read as a story from start to
finish.
Yes,
I think so too. Yes,
and the glossaries
are of named people. So
right, there are two different glossaries in the book. One of people that are corresponding, and one of people that are mentioned in the text.
So primary people and then secondary people. So yeah. What did you use to get biographies? You said you made phone calls and pretended you were relatives. You used, this is 1994. Mm. This is before Ancestry.com?
Yes.
So
for just to give you a
time
frame, the manuscript was on a dot matrix printer, okay. If that gives you any kind of
So you were writing it for how long? Putting it together for 10 years, 5 years, 4 years?
The Knowlton Papers?
Yeah.
No. We started the Knowlton Papers in August of 93, and it was published in October of 94.
Wow, that's really fast.
We knew we were going to be a good working team because we didn't kill each other when we were working on the Knowlton Papers. That, I guess, is what it amounts to.
It was the test, the trial by fire. So there's no Ancestry.com.
No.
So the local people that are mentioned, or let's say the prominent people, you've got books that have biographical information in them and photographs, and there's resources.
Right.
You find out the rest locally through what? City directories or?
City directories, the Historical Society's phenomenal collection.
So you have a name file?
There's a name file there, and there's a huge scrapbook collection there, which is a gold mine when you're looking for obscure things, because what do people put in scrapbooks? Obscure things of people that they know.
Right.
So you're not talking, you know, the big, well, sometimes the big people, but a lot of times just plain old ordinary people like you and me. You
well,
know?
And so city directories, city documents?
City documents. And then your visit to the New Bedford Public Library reference room, which is fantastic because they had all of the mass vitals on microfilm.
Oh, cool.
So you could look up all your...
It wasn't just that page with no information.
No, it was reels. You,
no, but I mean when you look
Oh, no, not the index?
Not the,
oh,
index, the index, which is the only thing you can find
That's
online.
The useless thing. That's it. When you click on it and then you go, ugh.
It doesn't do anything.
There's nothing there.
Because there's 15 people with that name,
But no, the actual mass vitals, births, marriages, deaths, they had all on microfilm. So if you had a name and an estimated death, you could check it and check the film, see if you can find it. There was a guy that was working there at the time. I think his name was Paul. Like, really, really helpful. And so that, Boston Public Library, same thing, microfilm. And
there were, for years, the only way you could get a copy of the trial transcript was through the Boston Public Library.
Mm-hmm.
With a permission from the Superior Court of Massachusetts.
Right. We were fortunate that we had a copy of the inquest transcript and the preliminary transcript at the Historical Society.
And did that come in a file?
Came in a different collection.
Okay.
But we had it as a research tool. Okay. So we could access testimony if we had to. And that was valuable. Also, the witness statements that were taken at the time.
The police witness statements, right.
Yes, yeah, we had those as well. So, again, all of this stuff that's on paper we had as resources, and didn't have the luxury of sitting down at a desk with a cup of coffee and something to eat.
Hey, you're talking about me now.
Yeah, I know. Of course I'm talking about you.
Yeah, but I don't have to leave my bedroom or change my clothes. Search the world now.
This is when you had to get out of your PJs to do research.
Yeah, you had to go to the Fall River Public Library to look for the Fall River newspapers on microfilm and on microfiche, and that's the only place it was, right?
And Massachusetts Trial, Boston Public Library. Again, it's the same thing. And tracking down the obscure people, it was a matter of making phone calls.
Well, even to this day.
City clerk's offices, downtown clerks.
Yes, yeah. But even to this day, Fall River hasn't digitized their death records. They still have to pull out the big book that goes from yar to there and open it up and read it with a yardstick all the way across both pages in order to get the right information. Sadly, you still have to contact them. And then now they charge for their time, which makes sense.
Yeah, So all in all, working on the Knowlton papers was my first major research project, working with Michael, and it was an excellent experience. And the publishing aspect of it was also very interesting, because the original intention was not what was the finished product, but it was kind of decided. We decided that it should have a look about it. Michael wanted it to have a legal volume.
Oh, I see.
Look, which it does.
Yeah.
So
the size and the paper, the heavy paper.
Yeah, the gilded edges. Mm-hmm. It take away the dust jacket, has a very 19th century look on the bookshelf.
It does.
Which is what we're aiming for.
Cool.
And even as far as the paper being off-white, a little ivory.
It was cream almost. Mm-hmm. That sold out, right?
Yeah. It was supposed to be a run of 1,000 copies. It ended up with the overrun of 1,165 copies that flew out the door. Yeah.
And it's just recently been republished in a paperback form.
It's in paperback now, which is great. In its craziness, in the secondary market, we saw it going as high as $650 for a single copy.
Goodness.
Yeah, which is, it's kind of like saying, when you think about what it is and what you went through to do it, and saying, are these people nuts?
I was in New York City one time, and we always would go to the bookstores, around off Broadway, just these great bookstores, Argosy and places like that.
Yeah.
And I walked into this bookstore, and I always go to social sciences, true crime, and history, because that's where you'll find some weird Lizzie book, right? So I found a Knowlton Papers. Mm-hmm. And I pulled it off the shelf and I looked at it and it was like $10. And I knew a friend of mine didn't have a copy.
Uh-huh.
So I bought it right away before they realized what they had. Because to me, it was gold. And it was looked like gold, but it was so profound that I found this copy. And it's light enough that you can carry it. So took it back with me and sent it off to the person who didn't have a copy, and they were very thankful. But you can still find them in interesting places without spending $650 if you want to.
Oh, well, the paperback has come out, the secondary market on the hardback has dropped considerably, I'm sure.
Well, tell us about the city directories a little bit as a resource for looking people up that have lived in Fall River, because there's some tricks to using a city directory, is there not?
Right. The city directories, for people that aren't familiar with them, are basically lists of all of the residents of the city. I'll qualify that. Before 1921, all of the men in the city, if you had reached your majority, which would be 18, and then women, if you were a school teacher, if you were a milliner, if you were a dressmaker.
So professional.
Professional, or if you were a widow.
Right.
If you were a housewife, you weren't listed in the directories until 1921, and no children were listed. After 1921, changed a little bit. You got women listed in brackets after their husband's name, their name. That would be if they were not employed. But if a woman was employed, she would be listed with her occupation. But the interesting thing about the city directories is that...
it's not a telephone book.
No, no. But it, you can look it up and say, okay, say I want to look up Dennis Bennett. Okay, so I'd get Bennett, comma, Dennis, and H, which mean house, and then my street address. All right, so say I had three sons that were all over 18 years old, but none had married. Well, if you looked and you saw Charles Bennett, B or BDS boards, same address. So you can actually track down
family
through the city directory.
And then it will say where they're, it'll say house, H-O, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll give, or sometimes it would say residence, wouldn't it? Or R-E-S?
Occasionally you'd see an R-E-S.
And then their business address would be there too, in parentheses. Right?
Yeah, well, if you were employed, like say it was Dennis Bennett was a sailmaker at this certain firm, or it would, there'd be a comma, then you'd have the name of the firm, the address of the firm, and then the house information where you were living. Or if you were boarding with someone, where you were boarding.
And now the problem comes in with the fact that Fall River renumbered their houses twice.
Once in the very early years, and then again in 1896 to accommodate additional properties on streets.
They also, didn't they formalize the left and the right on and even at that point?
Even and odd, yeah.
But then there's a problem because you're looking at an 1892 directory where somebody lives, and you go to the map and you try to find that house, and it's not the same address anymore because it changed in 1896.
Right. If you're tracking somebody through the 1890s, and the first assumption, if you didn't know that that was the case, would be that they moved, but they still lived on the same street, which is not the case. It was just that their house was renumbered. There was one atlas that existed that was like manna from heaven, which was a transcription atlas that listed numbers.
You have that?
It was on loan, I believe.
From the state library?
I'm not sure where it was from.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
No, that's like, I have to try to, let me write that down. I have to try to track that down because that is golden to be able to transcribe or translate what the address became. Ooh. Like the Sanborn maps, those are great. You know, the mm-hmm. Sanborn fire insurance maps, because they, in terms of research, you could look at the way the street was laid out in a certain time period, but they would cut the new building
and overlay it.
So that if you put it up to the light, you could see what the building used to look like underneath. So,
and that's what we do. The great research tool is holding a page of the atlas with a flashlight underneath it.
So there's all of these great tools that you still have to sit down and use. You still have to massage the information. It's not pecking a few keys on the keyboard and finding the information delivered to you. Like, in some cases, you can do that. But a lot of this is still the old-fashioned way and will always be the old-fashioned way.
Okay, case in point. Say you have a man's name and you look him up in the city directory and you find him and he lives on a certain street. Okay, then you want to know who else is in the household and there's no one mentioned in the directories at that same address. So what do you do? It's, okay, let me check out the census. So if you go to the census, then you find this man
which is now online through Ancestry.
Yeah, now you can get that online. You don't have to go to the public library for it. And you look up this man, and you see that he has a woman living there, identified as wife or housekeeper. Usually housewife is the other term. And then maybe children.
Keeping house.
Keeping house, sorry. And then the children, son, daughter.
Servants.
Servants, also identified.
Boarders.
Boarders. In-laws.
Right.
Would be identified.
Nieces and nephews, it tells you the direct relationship
to the head of household.
The head of household.
Yeah. Right. And so, I mean, that's a great tool. And so right there, you can go forward knowing that this man that you had is married to this woman and these are his children. So you find out information about the children. Okay, can you backtrack with the children and get in more information about the parents? And then it's a matter of going through the local newspapers, wedding announcements, anything like that.
Or even military records. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Yeah. And like pre-Ancestry days, the name files at the Historical Society, there would be scrapbooks with wedding invitations or descriptions of weddings in scrapbooks.
Right.
And so you would have somebody's name. They would be referenced for that scrapbook. You'd go there. You'd have information about who was in the wedding.
One of the things about Ancestry I think we should mention is you can't trust exactly or 100% the family trees that are created by people who are interested in that particular person.
Right. The thing about Ancestry is it's a tremendous tool for the actual documents. If you're looking for vitals and you get birth certificates, death certificates, or
you have the source and that it comes from.
The primary source, that's great. The family trees, it can be questionable. And your best bet is if you get information, then find another source that has the same information, at least one, if not more.
I have many, many times gone down a rabbit hole.
Yes.
Realizing they're talking about, they got this information all wrong.
The important thing about doing research is that when you think that you've found your answer, don't stop looking. Continue to look and verify that the answer that you found is actually the right one. Because all you have to do is try to research anyone named Sullivan.
Or Borden at one point.
Or Borden at one point. And you'll know that there are so many Sullivans or Bordens that have the same names.
Michael Sullivan, 1,000.
Daniel Sullivan.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Borden, for God's sake.
Yeah. Or Andrew Borden.
Yeah.
Because there were three of them.
Yeah, there were three Andrew Bordens in Fall River.
Andrew J. Borden's, two of those.
So you've got to make sure that you're actually have found or you're following the right person that you're looking for.
Exactly.
And then that's the biggest mistake that gets made so many times in research.
Even professional written genealogies that exist.
Have, yes.
Hattie Weld, is that?
Hattie Weld's Borden genealogy. Yes.
Has mistakes in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like big ones. And people go, oh, but it's in Hattie Weld that Lizzie Borden was related to Sarah Cornell. No, that's not right.
Isn't it Hattie Weld that misspells Lizzie Borden's middle name?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So you still have to verify. Right. She's not a primary source. She's somebody who used sources and then wrote it down. And there could be typos, you know, with any printed source.
Oh, right.
Right.
True.
So you always have to double check and triple check everything. When I was working on the paperback of Knowlton Papers, and I got to the glossary part, I wanted to flesh it out just a little bit more because your resources in 94 are completely different than the resources that are available today.
True.
So I was investigating further. Now we have Fall River newspapers that are searchable online with a subscription through newspapers.com, but they don't have all of them. There's years still missing.
Mm-hmm.
But they have them. And so for the first time, you can actually search for a person. And if you put it in quotes, which is makes a phrase out of it, and find every instance in a certain year or month or day where that person appears in the newspaper, and you find all kinds of amazing things. So I was able to flesh out a lot of detail for people who maybe got in trouble with the law, or people who whose children got married and there were wedding announcements, and you could trace it and you could find people in new ways using some more modern resources, which was fabulous. So the basis of the research was, of course, the original volume, and then adding to it and padding it with further information, finding out all the children's names and confirming that all these kids are really his kids. So it was a joy to work with the Knowlton papers, because it was 90% done, you know? It was just a reprint with some added material, but most of it was all there. Working on the Jennings journals with you was a completely different experience, and I'm sure we'll get to that in part two of this discussion.
Yes, Jennings
we'll
journal.
We'll do it chronologically.
Right. So, Knowlton Pearson correspondence and Jennings journals, I think, and Parallel Lives, of course, are going to be part two. I think so, too.
Uh-huh. I think so, too. Yes, because I think we've done our time today.
Very good.
Yeah, so we're going to pick this back up in part two. Maybe there'll even be a part three. We'll see.
That would be fine with me.
Because we have a lot more to talk about. We've only gone through like the first four questions, and I had like 12. So, oh my goodness.
You made up the questions. You are the boss. So tell me what to do and when to talk.
Well, you have so many great stories to tell that that's the best part. When you digress, they're golden. They're really gems of stories. So don't stop doing that.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dennis, for your time
no
today.
No problem.
I really appreciate
it. Was terrific.
It.
Thank you.
I'll be back soon.
Oh, thanks for the warning.
Thank you for listening to the Lizzie Borden Podcast, Episode 28. We've been talking to Dennis Bennett about researching Fall River history and the Lizzie Borden case. Be sure to look out for our next installment of this most interesting talk on our next podcast. Find Richard Barron's Lizzie Borden Girl Detective stories at Amazon.com and at LizzieBordenGirlDetective.com, where you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Listen to more Lizzie Borden podcasts on our website or on Podbean, Audible, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, and YouTube.